Good morning. May it please the court, David Koch here on behalf of Levette Chambers. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. It's my intention, subject, of course, to the court's preference, to focus on the first issue that we've raised in the briefing, and that is the giving of an instruction on manslaughter as a lesser included to intentional murder. We are asking this court to find that the instruction should not have been given based on the state's failure under Workman to show the factual prong, that is, to produce substantial evidence in which jurors could find that the lesser was committed to the exclusion of the greater. All of the evidence in this case, both from the state and from the defense, established that Mr. Chambers intentionally shot Mr. Hood intending to kill him. Mr. Chambers was an experienced gun user. He was in close proximity to Mr. Hood. He fired 3 times into the torso with a high caliber 45 pistol when facing the threat of deadly force from a shovel that Mr. Hood was holding at a time when he believed that his life was in danger. If you look at the state's closing arguments and really the whole presentation of their case, it's apparent that they also thought this was an intentional killing, because the multiple times during the closing they told jurors just that, that this was obviously an intentional killing. And the notion that this was merely manslaughter was really nothing more than almost an afterthought in terms of the state's closing argument, barely mentioned at all. And indeed, there is nothing to support a finding that this was anything other than intended. And in that respect, this case is like Perez-Cervantes. Now, Perez-Cervantes, as we discussed in the briefing, is the case where the defendant used a small pocket knife to stab the victim twice. The victim ended up dying because an artery was severed. At trial, the defense asked for a lesser-included defense instructions on manslaughter, even though he had been charged with intentional murder, on a theory that this was a small knife, and jurors could have found, therefore, that the only intent was to assault the victim, and that the death was due to recklessness and negligence rather than an intent to actually kill the victim. And the Supreme Court said no. You were not entitled to that instruction because you cannot overcome the presumption that an actor intends the natural and foreseeable consequences of his conduct. When an individual takes a knife and stabs an individual twice, natural consequences and the natural assumption is that there was an intent to kill. You can't simply rely on the fact that jurors may have disbelieved that and therefore found recklessness or negligence. You're not entitled to a lesser included offense. Now, there are certainly circumstances where it's appropriate to give manslaughter as a lesser, and those circumstances are outlined in cases like State v. Schaefer and State v. Jones. And the circumstances that are discussed in these cases are two. One is when you've got an intoxication defense, and the second is when there's an argument to be made that the amount of force that was used as part of self-defense was reckless in the amount of force that was used.
And so Schaefer relates to the last
scenario,
and Jones is an intoxication case. I think the state relies on another intoxication case.
They do. Jones is actually both, involves both of those scenarios. The other case they rely on is Collins, which is exclusively intoxication. That's correct. That's from Division III in 1981. Now, this clearly, Mr. Chambers' case is not an intoxication defense case.
No, it was not. It was self-defense. But
correct.
There was evidence that he was highly intoxicated.
There was evidence that he consumed a great deal of alcohol.
At the time.
Correct. No doubt about that. And there's also no doubt that later on in the evening after the shooting, he was certainly exhibiting the effects of having consumed a substantial
right.
amount of alcohol. The difference between this case, though, and Jones and Collins is that there was no instruction that was given to the
right.
jurors regarding a defense involving alcohol. And had a party in Mr. Chambers' case asked for the instruction, it would have been rejected because there was not substantial evidence that at the time of the shooting, Mr. Chambers was unable to form the intent to kill. In fact, the individuals who were with him that night at the bar, his friend, the bar staff, even the people who saw him walking away from the shooting afterwards indicated, no, it didn't look like he was stumbling around. Looked like he was pretty much in control of his faculties. And indeed, that's what Mr. Chambers testified to as well. So that scenario is not what we have here. The other scenario is what Schaefer deals with exclusively. And that is, you know, the situation where you've got self-defense, but the defendant recklessly uses too much force and thereby kills the victim. Now, in Schaefer, of course, you had Mr. Schaefer and Mr. McGee arguing in a bar. It spills out into the parking lot. They get into it. Mr. McGee puts his hand behind his back. Mr. Schaefer, thinking that at this point he faces some danger, some risk, pulls a gun. But he does not confirm the nature of the threat. Instead, he just opens fire, shooting Mr. McGee five times and killing him. And under those circumstances, the Supreme Court held, citing to Jones, that a lesser-included instruction on manslaughter was warranted, where the evidence showed that, you know, Mr. Schaefer initially had reason to believe that he was in danger, but then recklessly or negligently used more force than was necessary to repel the attack he perceived. And certainly shooting an unarmed man five times met the latter part of that test.
And so in this case, we have the victim with a shovel and a batter stamp.
Absolutely.
And is that the distinction?
It is the distinction. The distinction is that we have confirmation that the defendant, Mr. Chambers, faced threatened deadly force at the time that he used deadly force. That is the distinction, and it's critical. I think the state would like to read Schaefer.
How far away were they? Was it about 10 feet?
They were within 10 feet. I think, you know, they were asking Mr. Voss about this, and his testimony varied between 6, 7 feet, up to 10 feet. I mean, it was kind of like many things, it was sort of all over the place. But I think it's safe to say they were within 10 feet of each other, so in close proximity for certain.
Viewed in a light most favorable to the state, does Mr. Voss's testimony suggest that the decedent had put down the shovel, had turned to get into the truck at the time the gun was fired? Would that be more akin to Schaefer and excessive force?
If he had put down the shovel, if he was no longer holding the shovel, it seems like it would be sort of like Jones, where the victim was disarmed from the knife. He no longer had the knife. But that is not what this record shows. And defense, I think, really, you know, focused in on this point with Mr. Voss. And if you look at 28 RP 104 and 28 RP 163 to 164, Mr. Voss is very clear that at the time of the shooting, Mr. Hood still had the shovel in his hands. He had not dropped this shovel. It's true that Mr. Voss said that, you know, his impression was that Mr. Hood seemed to be turning, and his interpretation was to get back into the truck. But at the time, he's still holding the deadly weapon. He never put it down. And you also have to remember this all happened within 1 second's time. That was Mr. Voss's testimony. This is happening very, very quickly. So there's very little time to sort of figure out what Mr. Hood's intentions are, especially when he's still holding that shovel and did not drop the shovel until after he was shot. Once he dropped the shovel, there was no more shooting. But at the time of the shooting, he still had the shovel in his hands, and Mr. Voss confirmed that.
Did the forensic evidence shed any light on the time involved?
I don't know that it sheds light on the time involved. I think that the ME was very careful to say we can't even really tell the order of these shots. You know, we can say, yes, it could be consistent with this, it could be consistent with that. And I have talked in my briefing about one scenario that it's consistent with. But in terms of the timing of all this, I don't think the ME could say one way or the other based on the gunshot wounds. But, you know, the witnesses who were there in the area, including Mr. Voss himself, said this all happened very, very fast. It was boom, 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 everything within 1 second's time, according to Mr. Voss. I'll go ahead and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington. The respondent in this case, may it please the court, the defendant was convicted of manslaughter in the first degree, and that charge was properly put before the jury. Now, we're looking at the second prong of the Workman test. We don't rely on the closing argument that Mr. Koch just gave. This court doesn't weigh the evidence. This court doesn't weigh credibility. And this court must view the evidence in light most favorable to the party that asked for the lesser. It also doesn't have anything to do with what was argued in closing arguments, because unlike when the defense proposes a lesser included, and they argue for that a lot, sometimes that's what they're shooting for as opposed to an acquittal, they want the lesser. The state's not asking for the lesser because that's what we want or that's what we believe happened. That's just what we think the jury can properly rely on if they don't convict on the greater charge.
So viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the state, what was the evidence that would support giving the manslaughter instruction?
Well, I think the first thing we do is that we look at Schaefer, because this court asked the question about that. And I think
that was because the state didn't address it in the brief.
Well, but let's look at Schaefer, because Schaefer, the rule in Schaefer says if the defendant reasonably believes he's in imminent danger and needs to act in self-defense, but recklessly uses more force than necessary to repel the attack, you're entitled to a manslaughter instruction if there's an inference that occurred. Now, the defense wants to make distinctions, but what are the distinctions? It's not that the defendant was unarmed in McGee, because that wasn't the question. And the court doesn't say that. The defense got up here and said that Schaefer did not confirm the nature of the threat. Nowhere in Schaefer does it say that. They said perfectly that he had a right to act in self-defense. The question was, what could he do in acting in self-defense? And there was a question of whether it was reckless in firing multiple shots, just like the defendant here fired multiple shots. Now, let's look at the perceived danger as well.
So are you taking the position that just firing multiple shots equates to recklessness that allows the state to give?
No. I think you have to look at all of the facts. Well, it's a factual question.
I'm asking you what those facts are, viewing the evidence.
And that's exactly what I'm going into right now. Mr. Hood held a shovel that, by the evidence said, was 4 feet 10 inches long. That's a 27 RP 107 and 35 RP 21. Voss's testimony is that after Hood picked up the shovel and got into a batter stance, the defendant jumped back to up to 10 feet away. Now, Hood also has to put his hands on the shovel. So if he swings this shovel, this flathead shovel, he's going to miss him by a minimum of 5 feet. Now, in Schaefer, we're talking about a gun. Now, he didn't have one, but Schaefer thought he had one. That can be fired from a distance. It can be fired within a second, as Mr. Koch said. And it's obviously a deadly weapon per se. Shovel is not. The defendant, however, now, and the court asked a question about the other evidence. The evidence is that Voss was in the doorway. Hood was in the doorway of the truck. The door is open. He's got the shovel in a righty stance. That means his left shoulder was pointed towards the defendant, and his right shoulder is pointed to the truck. There are two shots that are square in his back, dead center. The other shot goes into his left chest, just around the breast area, underneath the skin, does not pierce the chamber, and goes into his left arm, which means he's the opposite way around. Mr. Voss testified at 27 RP 111 that as soon as Hood saw the gun, he spun and tried to get into the truck. That's entirely consistent with the ME's analysis of that wound, because it had to be fired at such an angle to go through his chest without penetrating the cavity and through his left arm. If he's still in a batter stance about ready to swing at the defendant, that shot can't occur. It wouldn't have happened that way. Those things support a reckless instruction. Also, what the defendant didn't do. The defendant is not in immediate harm when he steps back 10 feet from Mr. Hood. He could have done a lot of other things. He could have simply pointed the gun at Hood. He could have fired a warning shot. He could have just fired a single shot, since Hood doesn't have a gun he's shooting at him. He's got this unwieldy shovel 10 feet away from him. Now, I'm not saying this court has to believe those things or don't believe them. Those are all possibilities. And the Supreme Court said in that situation, it is appropriate to allow the jury to make that decision. And that's what was done here. There's nothing wrong with that.
Is there any way of determining whether the two shots in the back were the first two shots or the second and third shots?
Well, I don't know how. I can't think of a conceivable scenario that the two in the back could have been the first two shots. I mean, those were dead center mass. They went straight through him. He died very, very quickly. I can't think of a physical scenario.
It's more than just multiple shots.
Absolutely. It's where those shots occurred. I mean, he's already getting in the truck. He's already going down. He's been shot once, and you shoot him twice more in the back. Now, the defense can argue, well, it was really quick. Well, we don't exactly know how quick it was, but you have an opportunity to think beforehand. You've hit him once, you fired your gun, you've pulled it out, he's turning, he's getting into his truck, and then you fire two more shots. The jury is entitled to decide whether his actions were reckless or appropriate. It doesn't mean they have to find it. It doesn't mean this court has to find it. But the inference is there based on the evidence. And let me address the other case that this court asked me to address, and that is Perez-Cervantes. Now, in that case, Perez-Cervantes thinks that the victim has robbed from him in the past. So him and some accomplices go and they beat him up, and during the course of beating the victim up, Cervantes stabs the defendant twice with a pocket knife. He's convicted of murder too. He wanted on appeal, he says, I should have gotten a manslaughter instruction. Because he used a small knife, and the basis was, because he used a small knife, you cannot infer an intent to kill. And therefore, the Supreme Court says, by default, you could find the lesser. That's his argument. The Supreme Court says, no, you need evidence of recklessness. You need something more than that. And it didn't exist in that case. It wasn't a self-defense case, so you didn't have the issue of whether the defendant used more force than necessary. There were no, at least in the opinion, there are no, quote, reckless acts of the defendant that there are in this case, everything from arming himself into a car to not going into the bar to not calling 911 to not doing any of those things. Those acts didn't occur in that case. And there also wasn't a question about the defendant's mental state in that case based on either intoxication, drugs, or his past history of paranoia and PTSD. All of those factors occur in this case. It's very different. It is a fact-specific question. And in this case, you have the very things that did not exist in Perez-Cervantes.
How did the PTSD factor into the self-defense?
Well, I think
I know there was an expert. I know there was an expert. I know that there was PTSD evidence that was presented.
Yeah.
How did that relate to?
Well, I think one of the things that the jury could look at is they could look at the fact that he knew these things about himself. He had been diagnosed. Now, some of the things he discounted and says, I didn't believe the evaluators. But he also testified about, you know, where he sits. He always wants to see the door. You know, he said his life revolves around his fear of other people. Well, the jury's entitled to take those actions and say, okay, if this person is such fearful, are the actions he took reckless or not? Again, when he's in his car and one person he can't even see, he's gone, the other person is left, he's got his doors closed, he's got a gun right between his legs, a 45 semi-automatic, he's got his cell phone with him, and what does he do? He gets out of the car where the people are at, he takes his gun, he doesn't go into the restaurant that he's parked probably 10 feet from, he doesn't yell, doesn't call 911, doesn't try and start his car again, doesn't do any of those things. He takes really irrational action. At least the jury had a right to look at those and base those on irrational actions. And the defendant knew all these things about himself. And so based on that knowledge, he is reckless in taking those actions. At least the jury, again, is entitled to consider that, whether it's reckless or not. And I see I am out of time. Unless there's more questions, I'd ask the judge or ask the court to affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Schindler, in response to your question about whether it's the state's position that because there were multiple shots that made it reckless, that actually was Judge Doyle's position. That is what persuaded her to give this instruction, was that in her mind, Mr. Chambers could have just fired one shot, and it was the fact that he fired two and then three that allowed jurors to find this reckless. And if you actually think about that, it's somewhat counterintuitive that the more shots you take, the less intentional it becomes. Again, you know, the state is taking the position now that, well, you know, Mr. Chambers really wasn't facing any sort of danger or any sort of threat because of the distance between the two of them. But you have to remember that the entire time Mr. Hood was armed, everyone agrees, even under the state's version of events, that Mr. Hood had just been thrown around the N-word right before this. And even if they're 10 feet apart, somebody who's got a shovel and a baseball stance could either throw the flat-headed shovel 10 feet feet, could take one step forward. In an instant, it could be used as a deadly weapon against Mr. Chambers. And what distinguishes his case from the other cases in which, you know, recklessness could be proved in terms of the amount of force, like Schaefer, is, again, that we have this confirmation of the deadly threat that persists throughout the time that the shooting occurs. That's what takes this outside of Schaefer. And I believe if you look at Schaefer, that was the basis for their reasoning. That's what made it reckless in that case, is that he sort of jumped the gun against an unarmed man. And nothing could be further from the truth here. In terms, or nothing could be further from that than here. Now, in terms of PTSD, it really played no role in terms of the self-defense case, because if you look at 46 RP 154 to 155, which is defense counsel's closing argument, he told jurors that has nothing to do with this. PTSD, no PTSD, any reasonable person.
So why did they put it on?
They put it on because, I think mostly because they wanted to explain why he didn't remember everything that happened, and also to explain how he reacted to the homicide detectives, why he was not cooperative based on his long history that led to the PTSD. Those were the focuses of that diagnosis, not the self-defense claim.
All right.
With that, my time is out. I ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.